Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. We did it, Kieran. We managed to start a pod without chuckling at numbers on a screen. That's the first time we've done that in 3 weeks. How are you this morning, apart from excited about a certain invite you've just had in the post, like a Harry Potter letter from Hogwarts, delivered down the chimney by an owl?
That's right. I'm not excited as the Baroness. We've just had a formal invite from Buckingham Palace to pop in and, I don't know, talk amortisation or something. They didn't go into detail. We'll find out when we get there.
Yeah, I'd hide the credit card, Kieran. That's what I would do. I hope there are no photographs on this formal invite, because if there are, I would advise you to check them very carefully, Kieran. It's questions day, Kieran, but as we mentioned on the interview with Tom Bean that we did, there are two EFL clubs who have had points deductions in the last day or so. So I think we need to just mention that before we get into our questions.
Yes, Morecambe, who have been on the EFL's naughty step for some time, and this is due to the intransigence of the owners with regards to selling the club at a fair price. Bills haven't been paid, and to be fair to the EFL, they have set out, you know, they've made it very clear that if you don't pay your taxes, you don't pay wages and time and things like this, you are going to be subject to sanctions. The owners are aware of it. The owners have chosen to ignore the guidance and the instructions given by the EFL, and they've had a 3-point deduction as a result, which is disastrous for the fans, for the coach, for the players, because they had a chance of going in the playoffs. And now that's, okay, it wasn't a guarantee, but it's now quite a setback. And I feel so sorry, because there are so many good people at Morecambe who are doing things on a voluntary basis for the affection and love that they have for the local club. And then you've got somebody who's come in, bought the club for whatever reason. You know, they were never fans to begin with. They just saw it as an investment opportunity. And they've treated a lot of people with contempt and disrespect. That's one. And the other one is a strange one, because it's the EFL announcing a points deduction which perhaps will never arise, in the sense that it's been given to Sheffield United, who are, of course, in the Premier League. Now, under the agreement that they've got between the two institutions, the Premier League will not enforce off-pitch, i.e. points deduction, sanctions given by the EFL, and vice versa. They'll only enforce financial penalties. So Sheffield United, if they are relegated, and I know a lot of people will say, well, they're not far from being relegated, but they haven't been. And that they, you know, we both remember, wasn't it West Brom under Roy Hodgson a few years ago, you know, a good decade ago, an amazing turnaround.
I think it was under Gary Megson, but I can tell you who was relegated instead of them.
Right. Like to,
basically, on the last day drama, which is great if you're a West Brom fan, less so for us.
So, you know, there are matches still available. So if they avoid relegation, it will be when, or if, should we say, Sheffield United ever return to the EFL. So they will be starting on minus 2 points should that day arise. And this is in respect of non-payment of transfer fees. There's been some strange goings on, again, in terms of the ownership of Sheffield United. They did spectacularly well to get promoted last season. They then sold their two best players. They had very, very modest reinvestment. You know, this is a football finance show rather than the football show, but I think everybody was scratching their heads as to the lack of support for the manager at the time in terms of an investment in talent. And it looks as if the previous purchases which they'd made in the Championship, despite having the benefit of parachute payments, were not being made on time. And I think the the total number of days overdue in respect of four or five transfers added together came to around about 600 days. So, you know, we are severely taking the mickey with regards to what you're supposed to do in terms of doing the right thing. And Sheffield United have received large sums of money from the Premier League, A, in the form of parachute payments, and B, when they returned to the Premier League itself upon promotion. So that's something to not look forward to if you're a Blades fan.
Two things, Kieran. First of all, from a Sheffield United point of view, we talked on the last pod about how much is owed by Premier League clubs to clubs around the world. It's billions of pounds. So I think there'll be some Sheffield United fans going, well, hang on a second. Well, when do sanctions kick in for the money that Premier League clubs owe to other clubs? And the second thing is, you know, Morecambe fans, Sheffield United fans, I imagine Morecambe fans are probably very angry. Sheffield United fans are probably philosophical about the whole thing. But at least in the EFL, you know where you stand. The EFL say, these are the rules. These are the sanctions if you break the rules. You've broken the rules. These are the sanctions. Contrast that to the situation in the Premier League where Everton and Forest have gone into these hearings with no one really knowing what the outcome would be if they were found to be in breach of the rules. It seemed like the Premier League were making these things up as it, you know, it turns out is an automatic 3-point deduction, but no one knew that beforehand. And then you can have a point taken off if you turned up wearing a nice suit. And it just seems the EFL way is a much better way. I might not be saying that if I supported a club in the EFL that was having points deducted, but you know why they're being deducted, because the owners of your club have blatantly flouted the rules.
That's right. And, you know, let's be perfectly transparent here. We've got to know Trevor Birch. We know Nick. We know some of the other people at the EFL. They've always been honest with us, and they've always been straight down the line. And I think on the back of that, clubs, as you rightly said, know, well, if we do X, then Y is going to happen to us. I think part of the problem in the Premier League is because it is now civil war within the Premier League itself. And people talk about the Premier League as, you know, Richard Masters has come in for a lot of criticism, some of which may be merited, a lot of which is not, however. He cannot dictate to the clubs what the sanctions can be. It has to go to a vote. It has to be discussed. You know, we've just had a chief executive meeting, and there's going to be new cost control rules coming in. We'll discuss at another point in time. The penalties for those are going to be discussed at the next meeting. So again, that doesn't seem to me like joined up thinking, yes, we're going to bring in cost control, but what happens if you break? Well, we'll get round at some later date. Yeah, surely you should have a comprehensive and a cohesive approach to this. The Premier League has had 10 years, or rather Premier League club owners have had 10 years to come to an agreement as to what are appropriate sanctions. And they've consistently failed to do that. Now, either because perhaps they thought that such sanctions and a breach of the rules, because losing £105 million over threes, that means it's, you know, pretty spectacular losses, because those are £105 million worth of FFP losses, which are probably closer to £200 million of regular losses. You've got all of these amazing TV deals coming in. You've got the popularity of the Premier League. They probably thought it's never going to happen, but it has. And I know that there is an element of feeling as far as clubs are concerned, is that if the Premier League announced the rules, what we might have is certain clubs deliberately gaming the system. They say, okay, if we sign this player and we don't sell this player, we think it's going to be worth 8 points to us. We know that it's going to only be a 3-point deduction on the basis of our calculations. So people start getting cute. Now, that's a very, very risky strategy. And it's something that, you know, I would never advise anybody. You know, what happens if that player turns out to be crap? What happens if the player you were going to sell, you decided not to sell, you know, did their ACL? Yeah, you know, there are so many variables in football. But you know, as we've always said, we're not cynics. But if I was a cynic, I wouldn't trust some clubs to say we'll just take on this particular sanction because we believe that in doing so we'll actually be better off overall in terms of the points we'll generate.
Well, the trouble is, Kieran, that the bottom line is there's too much money to be gained in the Premier League. So people will start taking risks to stay there and to get there. Our first question, Kieran, comes from Kieran. It comes from Kieran Fullop. And it's about something that is increasingly agitating our listeners, and that's the use of football grounds for that their pop music. That Kieran Fullop, I have to say, begins with a value judgment. And because Kieran's question starts with bombastic pop princess Pink, and he said, I would have started that by going Pink. And then you and I could discuss whether or not she was a bombastic pop princess or you'd been invited backstage to meet her, as you increasingly are being by various mid-ranking 90s floppy-fringed young bands. But Kira says, bombastic pop princess Pink played two sell-out gigs at the home of Bolton Wanderers last year with over 70,000 people paying up to £150 for tickets to see the show. It seems that Pink is a fan of the English Football League, with the UK leg of her world tour eschewing the bright lights of London, Manchester or Newcastle for gigs at Bolton, Sunderland and Birmingham. When you throw in hospitality, merchandise and refreshments, there's serious money being generated here for those clubs. I was wondering whether you know what sort of fee the clubs charge for hosting these shows, or do they simply take the money spent on the day? I mean, that's our approach, Kieran. We'll charge a small fee to Salford and then they keep the bar. But I imagine Pink's people probably work on a slightly different deal, don't they?
Yes. It is very organised. It is very forensic and detailed. I've not seen any contracts themselves, but I took a look at Sunderland's accounts for 2022, and they generated nearly a third of their total revenue from what they call catering, conferencing and banqueting. And that would include, this would come under that overall umbrella. So I think we are talking significant amounts of money. Again, if you take a look at Bolton Wanderers accounts, you know, what they call sort of commercial retail corporate sales, £2.5 million for last summer in total, that would potentially include some of the money coming from hosting these events. So what tends to happen is that you charge a fee for the hire of your facilities, and then you come to a profit share. So, I think when we were trying to sell T-shirts at one of our gigs, didn't one of the venues want 25% of the total? So it'll be along those lines. And when it comes to catering, Spurs, for example, put up the price of beer and pies and general foodstuffs for NFL matches compared to when Spurs are playing. And then there's a bit of a profit share goes into that as well. So on a line-by-line basis, these things are very lucrative. And fair play to Pink. I'm not overly familiar with her music because it didn't involve wearing a long raincoat or having a floppy fringe. So therefore, immediately ruled me out. But there will be, we're talking a six-figure fee for the hire of the facilities. And then if the Pink merchandise is being sold on the premises, then there will be a further fee. Because I know I went to see The Cure at Wembley Arena about 18 months ago. And Robert Smith, who has taken on the industry in terms of what they refer to as dynamic pricing, but what we call as ripping off the fans, he was so hacked off that there were official Cure stalls outside Wembley, simply because if there's, I want to be able to sell the stuff at a reasonable price. You know, the fans have stuck with me for 40 years or so, and rightly so. Yeah, who can not ever stop being a fan of The Cure, in my view. And to reduce the amount of money which is being taken by the venue and the promoter.
That who could ever stop being a fan of The Cure question, Kieran, is deliberately provocative, as you well know. There's Ali and I are coming up to a very significant wedding anniversary soon, and if anything was ever going to split us up, it would be that music being played overly loudly on a constant basis. The cure and Elbow are things that Ali and I do not agree on. Right? It's just, seriously, They say, was it the shortest element of time in the world is between a traffic light changing in New York and the car beeping? I can challenge that with Elbow coming on the radio and me reaching for the radio. It's just, you know, if they could do, I appreciate they've got one good long song and one good short song, but they just need to stop writing the same song over and over again, essentially. That's Elbow. There, Keo haven't got any long songs. But I feel the same way.
I think you'll find they have.
No, they just seem long, Kieran. Jamie Green, interestingly, has a follow-up question about this, or more likely, when Guy read the first question, he probably thought to himself, I'm sure there's a question similar to this somewhere down the back of the sofa. But Jamie Green says, it's a similar setup, but he points out that Sunderland, for example, as you just mentioned, have had a great number of concerts at the Stadium of Light. He says, from recent memory, Beyonce and Coldplay. And in brackets, Jamie says, I feel sorry for the local residents there. Which indicates that Jamie's not a fan of Beyonce and Coldplay. Because you'd sell your house, wouldn't you, for the night on Airbnb to Beyonce fans. But anyway, as Jamie says, these gigs obviously generated income, as you've just confirmed, Kieran. But does this income count towards transfers and FFP, which is an interesting question, really, whether you break down income so you can avoid FFP. But he makes a good point as well. This is another commercial area with clubs with more traditional football stadia like Palace or Portsmouth are missing out on important revenue and breathing space with relation to FFP because, you know, our grounds are not fit for purpose for these sorts of. I remember when we went to Plymouth last summer, Kieran, they would have they were digging up the pitch, weren't they, to have two massive concerts in the next few days, which again would have made a lot of money for them.
That's right. We were the meat in the Muse and Rod Stewart sandwich, which I never thought this podcast would ever be. In respect of Jamie's question, this is classified as commercial revenues. It's been generated through the stadium, and therefore the income which is created as a result does form part of your overall FFP PSR calculations and goes into that overall pot. And it's spectacularly successful, I think, in Spurs' case and so on. With regards to the impact on clubs like Palace and Portsmouth, we've got the Emirates, we've got the London Stadium, we've got Spurs Stadium. They're going to get first dibs at global musical stars. So, you know, it's not because Palace's stadium is not fit for purpose necessarily. I suspect, having heard about your grumpy groundsman, there will be a one-man protest if anybody ever thought about stepping foot onto the hallowed turf. But that's a separate issue. I think the problem is that there's so much competition. And also, I was talking to a chief executive of a club about this very topic last week, and he said getting everything in alignment, because you've got actually a relatively short window from the end of the season probably to no more than the second or third week in July at a push, because you know, you do want, the groundsman does want their pitch back. But you've actually only got very few weeks, and then that's got to fit in with that particular band, and the band has to be of a certain size. So you know, it's got to be the Foo Fighters or Muse or Taylor Swift or something of that nature, and they're going to sell more than 25,000 tickets. Yeah, they're going to be a 60 or 70,000 ticket performance artist. So that makes it more difficult. So getting everything to work in the right lines. Yeah, Muse did it and Rod Stewart because they're sort of there's geographical history, I think, in respect of Muse because they're from Devon. And Rod Stewart, you know, Rod, he's not the first person you think of when you think of, you know, today's artist. But you know, they also have he's got a legacy fan base, so that would have worked. So it's actually quite difficult to get all of the ducks pointing in the same direction. And then there could be further covenants and restrictions with regards to whether the council will allow the activity to take place. I know in the case of Beyonce, I think the local council had given Spurs the rights for six nights of Beyonce, and it was such a popular performance that they ended up selling seven. And I think there was a bit of a grumble between the two. And of course, you know, we've both been to Spurs. What about the local residents? You know, would you want people traipsing through your front garden, or, you know, and being hijinks taking place for seven nights consecutively? So there are broader considerations than those of revenue maximisation of the football club itself.
Yes, yeah, if I lived in Tottenham and Beyonce was doing a country and western show, I would have to move. way beyond it. I'll tell you what Rod Stewart has got these days, Kieran. Rod Stewart has got an incredible model railway layout.
I've seen that.
I know. And isn't it a tragedy that we've both reached an age where we're actually using the word incredible about somebody's model railway layout?
Yes.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Our next question, Kieran, comes from David Gorton. And David says, with Newcastle United agreeing a multi-million pound deal with Saudi Arabian company Sellout last year, are there any financial considerations that the Premier League may have in terms of inflated deals above market value and a mates rates approach to securing funding, agreeing to waive something through that wouldn't be available to other clubs based on geolocation? It sort of happened to PSG, did it not, Kieran, at the time?
Yes, I think there was talk in respect of PSG that because the French government were in negotiations with Qatar with regards to a particularly lucrative financial deal, that there would be a relaxed approach taken in the French football. well, I think this is one of the things. Yeah, and look, we know where our mast is well and truly stapled to in respect of the independent regulator. But there have been a couple of articles, one written by some lunatics from a right-wing libertarian think tank in the Times, and also one from Richard Masters in the Times in the past couple of weeks, which I find a bit strange because, A, he had said at the Department of Digital Culture, Media and Sport that he was not going to lobby for the regulator to take place. And secondly, the Times appears to be not giving a right of reply to people that might have an alternate view, which is disappointing from the Thunderer, but that's where it goes these days. But one of the criticisms which is levelled of a potential regulator is that could there be political interference in respect of decisions? There have been some nudge-nudge, wink-wink comments made about the potential pressure put on the Premier League to approve the Newcastle takeover, for example, and nobody knows as to whether those rumours are true or not, but it certainly hasn't stopped them from doing the rounds. So could this be the case in the regulator? I mean, if you take a look at the regulator's remit, it's actually very, very clear that in terms of the owners and directors test, political and geopolitical issues would not be taken into consideration. They'd effectively be ignored. If you don't like the human rights record of a particular country, that would not in itself form a reason for preventing an acquisition of a club. So therefore, could there be pressure put by the regulator to approve a deal? Again, from my reading of the legislation That would not be the case. The regulator would not get involved in individual contracts with regards to either players or sponsorship or commercial deals such as these. Could the Premier League take a bigger picture, i.e. if Club X is given a very generous front of shirt deal and at the same time the Premier League is in discussion with the national broadcaster of the country where that sponsorship deal is coming from? Business is business. I'll say no more than that.
That Richard Masters article in the Times was very, very strange because it was essentially him finding 12 ways of saying a regulator may affect the competitiveness of the Premier League without explaining in any of those ways what actually he meant by that and how that would happen. In terms of a response to that, Kieran, luckily we know a football finance pod, not a million miles from here, who will be speaking soon to the Minister for Sport, so perhaps we'll put that to him. It, just in terms of the specifics of David's question, though, I wonder whether the PSG thing, and I think less so with City, was, I think David might be asking what the Premier League could do if a sponsor, for example, an airline, vastly overinflated the effect of the sponsorship deal, if you see what I mean, to lower the losses of a football club in terms of their FFP.
Well, we do have a fair market panel now. So let's say that Airline X gave a £50 million a year deal to a football club and people said, well, hold on, they've only got three aircraft. That's clearly not commercial. And you do wonder, but then a lot of people have asked a similar question with regards to Chelsea sponsorship from Infinite Athlete this season, because they're going, well, that doesn't appear to be a very big organisation in its own right. So there is this thing called a fair value panel, which decides whether or not it thinks that given the size of the club, the value of the deal is appropriate. And if the fair value panel comes to a different conclusion, you can still receive £50 million cash, but they say, well, hold on, we only think it's worth £10 million a year, so we're only going to allow £10 million of that for FFP calculations. So that is now sort of embedded into the psyche of the Premier League.
Our next question, Kieran, comes from Julian Soons. And I think I know the answer to this myself, Kieran, but I've reached that stage where I'm second-guessing myself. I'm not sure if I do know the answer. But Julian says, why have my club, Lincoln City, not allowed children to wear or buy a shirt with the gambling shirt sleeve and league sponsorship Sky Bet on it for the last few years? Clubs in the Premier League and some championship teams allow children to wear and buy shirts with gambling companies as front-of-shirt sponsors. Are these double standards or is it a legal issue because they're under 18 years of age? If so, why doesn't this apply to front-of-shirt sponsors?
Well, I think it does apply. I know that West Ham, for example, with regards to their deal with Betway, the kids' shirts does not include that. As far as Lincoln City are concerned, they are part of Fair Game, which is sort of a lobbying organisation of various interested parties, including some clubs, and the vast majority of people connected with Fair Game have said that we do not want to be connected with gambling sponsors. Yeah, we know the likes of Tranmere and other clubs have kept at arm's length. So in my view, I don't think it should be allowed. And I think many clubs, to be fair, the gambling, we've had the gambling discussion, too many times to bring it up again. But I think it would prove to be a step too far for many clubs, even those that do have gambling sponsors on the front. You tend to get a blank shirt because it just feels inherently very, very ugly to have an 8-year-old child being used as a billboard for an organisation connected with a product which ruins lives.
Yeah, well, this is why I started second-guessing myself, because I was fairly certain I did know the answer, because certainly when Palace was sponsored by Manbet X, the children's shirts had a completely different sponsor on there, the music charity on, which I assumed was a Premier League regulation at the time, but now Julian's got me wondering whether it was a club regulation. But I'd, so no, anybody I'm, out there, I'm fairly certain you, In fact, I'm 99.9% certain that under 18s are not allowed to wear shirts with over 18 subject. I mean, they're not allowed to gamble, so why would they be allowed to wear? So if somebody could, it's in the book, Ken, that's what I should have done. there's definitely a chapter on this, and this is why this is terrible. This is why I don't apply to do celebrity quizzes, Kieran, because I would go Battle of Waterloo, yes, 1815, and then I would say, I tell you what, Richard, that's 1816. They go, no, it's not, it's 1815. So, yeah, I know the answer to this, but that pesky Julian's got me. I've used that expression before. Never mind. Simon Dorset has this next question. Simon says, how does FFP work for clubs promoted to the Championship from League One? I read that at the end of their first season, their last 3 years' accounts were assessed as if they had been in the Championship for all of those seasons. But now I cannot find where I read it, and I'm starting to wonder if this was a misinterpretation on my part. Simon, welcome to my world. The amount of times I've sat in the Porson's Arms going, my fallback position now, Kieran, is if I can't find the proof, I say, you told me. I say, I know. I'm fairly certain Kieran told me this. Yeah, that's definitely, yeah.
Well, Simon, I draw your attention to page 417, section 6.3.1 of the EFL handbook. And the reason why you've probably not read it is because you've probably got a life and a personality. Now, I have the benefit of neither of those, and therefore I am no stranger to page 417, section 6.3.1 of the EFL handbook, which specifically states that in terms of calculating the PSR maximum spend, for every year that a club is in the Premier League, you're allowed to lose £35 million. And then for every year you are in the EFL. So that doesn't actually specifically say the Championship. So for every season that you are an EFL member, it is £13 million. So therefore you could be promoted from League 2 to League 1 to the Championship. You could be in three different divisions, and for each year you'd be assessed as being allowed a maximum of a £5 million loss plus a further £8 million in terms of owner funding.
Yeah. Our next question, Kieran, is from Alex Dobson. Alex says, do you think a hard salary cap could be better for English football than people might think? If it was set to, say, £200 million or lower, then clubs in theory could be saving money that could be reinvested in other areas. Also, the potential for clubs to become profitable business can never be seen as a bad idea. And finally, from the Premier League's perspective, this could be a chance for them to continue to stay ahead of other leagues. For example, if player talent was redistributed to other Premier League clubs so they could fit within the cap, then the competitive balance of the league might increase, thus leading to greater viewership. Now, Kieran, we are planning to discuss in the next week or so other alternatives to FFP, which are being discussed, as you say, at Premier League level, including the luxury tax. So I think we will be looking at this in greater detail. But by all means, if you want to give a sort of pricey answer to Alex now, then that would be interesting.
Yes. Well, first of all, I absolutely take on board Alex's comments. He has used the word better. And better is a really interesting word, because better for whom?
Okay.
Because if I'm Kevin De Bruyne, it's probably not better for me. If you take a look at Chelsea under Roman Abramovich and Manchester City under Sheikh Mansour, their wages had a significant increase. I can't find anybody at Chelsea who was unhappy about that. The managers were able to train better players. The players were getting paid more money. The fans were seeing trophies being won. The local pubs were selling more beer because the matches were sold out every week. And the owner was getting a soft power stroke vanity asset, rosy glow on the back of that. So those clubs were fine. You could argue that clubs elsewhere were not as happy. And also, with regard to Alex's final point, if player talent was redistributed to other Premier League clubs they could fit within the cap, then the competitive balance of the league may increase. I absolutely agree with that first part of that sentence, thus leading to greater viewership. Well, the evidence points otherwise. And again, I go back, and I know I've mentioned, probably bored people's pants off with this particular point before. When you talk to Sky, when you talk to other broadcasters, the romantic Leicester City winning the Premier League in 2016 was a bad year for them. They had the lowest viewing figures for around about a decade, because even towards the end of the season, and I was tuning up, I wanted Leicester to win. You know, I think that many sort of legacy fans, you thought this was absolutely fantastic. We are in the minority. The majority of fans, especially the majority of overseas fans, they want to see the big clubs win everything. They are not interested in romance. They are not interested in the fact that, you know, boring old farts like me and you can say, well, you know, I remember when Derby County and Nottingham Forest and Everton and Aston Villa and Blackburn Rovers, I remember when Ipswich won the UEFA Cup and so on. I remember, remember when Dundee United under Jim McLean. They're not interested in any of that. They want to see the biggest clubs with the best players in the world play each other on a regular basis. So as much as I would love to say that it would benefit the viewing figures, that wouldn't be the case in practice.
I'll tell you what, Kieran, much as I'm a proud Legacy fan, and I am, I'm happy to wear that T-shirt with the words Legacy fan underlined, I could watch Real Madrid Man City once a month, yes, if it was like that, yes, game the other night. Wow. all of them, and the PSG Barcelona game. Our last two questions, Kieran, I find really interesting, which is odd because they're both about finance. Normally, it's this stage of the pod, I'll start checking my messages to make sure I haven't missed anything, working out, do we need cat litter? Yes, we do. But the first question comes from Paul Main. And Paul says, roughly how much do transfer add-ons increase the amount of the transfer? What percentage of add-ons are triggered? And how do clubs account for the add-ons? And this last bit of the question is the one that particularly interested me. Do clubs assign some sort of probability factor to an add-on being achieved? Like, you know, i.e. again, we probably won't win the Champions League, so bung that in the contract.
It is an intriguing one, Paul. What I would always recommend anybody to do if they've got a particular interest in this area is to go to the small print of a club's accounts. Now, you know, that instantly means that even with our fairly dedicated listenership, 95% of people are now switched off. But for anybody that is, there's an area towards very much at the back of each set of accounts, which is called contingent liabilities and contingent assets. And what this does is it sets out where clubs think there is, in respect of what they might have to pay in add-ons, where they think it is going to be less than a 50-50 chance. So, you know, let's take the sale of Caicedo to Chelsea. If one of those clauses was, if he plays 20 matches for Chelsea, Brighton get another £5 million, you'd probably say, that's quite probable. Yeah, even if he's a bit rubbish. So therefore, Chelsea say, right, we were going to include that. So more than a 50-50. If another one of those clauses was within the 5 years of the contract, or in the case of Chelsea, within the 8 years of the contract, he wins the FIFA Player of the Year award, you probably think, yeah, ain't going to do that. So therefore, we're not going to include. So that is actually included. And some of the clubs have huge numbers. If you take a look at the small print in Manchester United and Manchester City's accounts, the numbers, we are talking tens and tens of millions of pounds. So that is one way of determining whether there's a 50-50 chance of it arising or not. If it is more than 50%, you don't actually see that number elsewhere. It just becomes lost in the overall amount paid in respect of players. So you see, yeah, that this is the total amount we've spent on players, including those 50% or more. And that's as far as it goes. So that's how we deal with the probability factor. In terms of how much do transfer ends increase the amount of a transfer, it varies very much, again, from contract to contract. And a lot of the time, you don't know what the position is going to be. You know, Birmingham, when they sold Bellingham to Germany, they had a 20% sell-on contract. They go, well, 20% of what? So we know we could be potentially, yeah, it could have been 10%, could have been 20%. But yeah, so a lot of the time you are dealing with unknowns. You only account for those figures when the contract, what we refer to as crystallizes, i.e. when Bellingham actually physically moved to Real Madrid. We now know the precise amounts, and that's when the numbers start to pile through into the account. So it is one of the dark arts of accounting and finance. There's a lack of clarity because you're dealing with unknowns, and because accountants are naturally cautious and prudent and very reserved in their outlook. You don't tend to see those figures quantified in advance because you don't want to build up people's hopes a lot of the time.
Our last question, Kieran, comes from Chris Hayward, and it's one of those questions I love, which on the face of it is a simple question, but it's one of those things that you think, I should have thought of this before, because it's so simple. But Chris says, my mobile phone and broadband contracts stipulate that my bill will increase annually with inflation. Are there any standard clauses within player contracts at all for their wages to increase in line with domestic inflation on an annual seasonal basis? If so, is it based on CPI or RPI or an alternative metric? Similarly, are players' wages subject to currency fluctuations as well? I just think this is a really interesting question, Kieran, because in some areas there will be automatic pay increases based on inflation, won't there?
There will. I mean, if I answer Chris's second question first, with regards to currency fluctuations, this is actually quite an important issue, because if somebody signs a player, so if a player signs for, say, somewhere like Turkey, where they've got pretty horrendous inflation, what you will do is that you might tether your salary to the euro or the dollar or whatever it's going to be, rather than the value of your local contract.
Is that Buckingham Palace protocol department phoning up?
Producer Guy.
Is it?
Producer Guy, blimey, O'Reilly.
He hasn't phoned me. This is...
Yeah, no, that's more important than royalty when we get summoned.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if that means I'm not in trouble or I am in trouble.
I'm always in trouble. That's my default position in life.
Just texting back saying, we're doing it. We're doing it now.
Exactly. So
currency,
there are certainly issues in terms of currency. So, and this can be an issue on a broader level. With regards to the fact that we do have hyperinflationary issues in respect of some countries. So with regards to inflationary rises, I've not seen or heard of any, but I've also seen a 4 or 5 year contract where there are step-ups, which aren't necessarily linked to a particular inflationary rate, but they are of something which you can say, well, the player's going to get, you know, £1,000 in year one, £1,200 in year two, £1,500 in year three, and so on.
I mean, I suppose, as a non-accountant lawyer, there are certain players... Oh, he's phoning me now. There are certain players... An annual inflationary pay rise would be huge.
He phoned Fenley. Fucking hell.
If we get too professional for you people at home at any stage. Yes. The likes of Harry Kane, if inflation in Germany was to get higher, then Harry Kane would be rubbing his hands together with glee, wouldn't he, on the sort of contract he has.
Yes. Well, yes and no, because inflation eats away at your ability to spend money. So, yes, you've got more money coming in, but you've got more money going out on an automatic basis anyway. So you'd have to say, well, are you net positive or net neutral or net negative?
Okay. Thank you to everyone who's donated to the pod via our Patreon page. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to the pod as well, that'd be very kind of you, and it'd get you access to our chat community and our regular quizzes, and you can do that by going to patreon.com/priceoffootball. If you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com, and you can go to the same website to get our book or our T-shirt. We'll be back on Thursday with our regular news pod. In the meantime, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell via warning you well in advance that we are going to shift the questions pod, the one you're listening to now, from Mondays to Tuesdays. Apologies if this messes with your weekly routine, but recording and editing on Sundays is proving trickier than it was when we started out. We'll make that switch in May. You know, producer guy's got me paranoid now that he's phoning us both to say that Everton have had a 25-point deduction and we need to mention it on the show. Anyway, in the meantime, I'll see you in 10 minutes for an emergency extra pod, given if that is the case. In the meantime, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, slightly alternate to that, I just want to say a huge thank you from both myself and Kevin to regular listener Stephen Webb, who is based in Australia.
Ah, indeed, yes.
Who has very kindly sent us shirts for Melbourne Victory, because Melbourne Victory are sponsored by Bonza Airlines. So we will be wearing these with pride. And I'd also like to say that clearly we've got we both have got voices of gravitas on the show, because both shirts have been sent in 2XL size.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.